SRN, your daily commute companion.
And good morning to you. Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you on Life Matters. How are you today? Fantastic to have you with us. Have you been scammed? Internet scammers. You know, they used to be Nigerian heiresses proffering their millions via a spam email. Now the scammers are pulling heartstrings on popular dating websites before they pull your purse strings in the most sophisticated ways. They're actually very patient too. And as investigative journalist Sofia Stefanovic discovered, even when people discover they've been scammed, letting go of the illusion of love can be too hard for some. And these aren't people that are necessarily gullible either, as you'll hear from her investigation. Also, sun, surf, sand, stingers, quintessentially Australian summer experience. We take it for granted until it's taken away. At RN Life Matters, tweet us, won't you? Last May, when Treasurer Joe Hockey announced the government's plans for an out-of-pocket co-payment each time you visit the GP, many felt that that was too bitter a pill to swallow, despite it being sweetened with the promise that the money collected would be allocated to a $20 billion medical research future fund. Some read it as a bribe, a chipping away of our universal healthcare system. The Senate certainly continues to block the Medicare co-payment, and this morning there are newspaper reports of growing expectations that the Prime Minister might dump it altogether. So what will that mean for the Medical Research Future Fund? Will it go by the wayside? A group of heavy hitters in medical research here in Australia have combined forces in this week's Medical Journal of Australia to champion such a fund, arguing that it is critical for the nation's health and its wealth, including two guests who join us now, Professor Christine Bennett, who is Chair of Research Australia. They're the peak research advocacy group for over 170 organisations. She's also Dean of Medicine at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney. Welcome, Christine.
Good morning.
And with us on the line is Professor Brendan Crabb. He's Director and CEO of the Burnett Institute and the immediate past President of the Association of Australian Medical Research Institutes. Welcome, Brendan.
Thanks, Natasha.
Brendan, to what extent do you think the politics surrounding this co-payment have taken attention away from the proposed Medical Research Future Fund?
Oh, almost completely. You mentioned in your introduction it being one way around. Of course, another way of looking at it is that in May, in a, you know, a very obviously austerity-driven budget, there was at least one... you know, shining light, and that was this Medical Research Future Fund, which was looking a long way forward for sort of the health and economy of the country, and also announced with it was a way of funding it that was obviously, at least in part, highly controversial. And what that really meant was, you know, not only was the fund going to be difficult to actually come into being, but really its benefits were completely lost.
Well, some people read it as a bribe. You know, your suggestion is that the fund and co-payment should be very separate things, or are very separate things, but in the public's mind, they're not.
No, I'm not saying they're separate things. I'm saying that there was a great new scheme announced, and of course, as governments like to do, announced ways to fund it at the same time. So, that's how I saw it, and of course, that way was highly controversial, even, of course, amongst our own members have very different views about that.
But I think the concern was that it wasn't really about a medical research future fund at all. It was a way of chipping away at the universal healthcare system.
Well, I don't see that as consistent at all with the Prime Minister in his time as opposition leader, for example, and the opposition more generally have been incredibly supportive of health and medical research. The very first thing Tony Abbott mentioned in his budget reply speech as opposition leader during the election year was medical research and how fantastic it was. In his time as health minister previously, he's doubled the funding to medical research. It's been top of mind for him and the Coalition, and of course pretty top of mind for Labor too, for a very long time. So that just doesn't ring true.
Christine Bennett, researchers always want more money. Is this plea in support of a medical research future fund by the collective who have written this piece in the Medical Journal of Australia, is it any different from every other call for more funds that we've heard before?
I think this piece was important, as you said earlier, to really shine the light on why we need this powerful investment in health and medical research. And we all have so much evidence of why we should do this. First of all, we're very good at it. We are very productive, and we've got some amazing discoveries and inventions that are making a difference to people's health around the world. And yet, less than one in five, around one in six, of the fantastic research that was put forward to the National Health and Medical Research Council was funded this year. So we're falling well short of actually supporting the potential we have. And also, we need to start thinking about how we invest in research so that it's embedded into our health system to improve quality and efficiency, and to bring early access to treatments and discoveries to the Australian population. So I actually think, as Brendan has said, that this is health and medical research is something that's supported with bipartisan support, and actually with whole of community support. This is not just researchers saying we need more. It's the whole of community, including the public and industry.
Well, I pick up on that point of how we invest that you make, because that is key to this fund, isn't it? And one of the complications here is that often funding is for applied research. The thing about research is that you don't often know what outcome is going to be on the horizon. How do you see then a future fund being utilised for, well, the kind of blue sky uncertainty of much research?
Well, I think first of all we need to have the fund. So let's get the fund established and then start a dialogue about how to best invest. But from our perspective, we are very good at discovery research. We publish well above our size as a nation, and yet we're not that great at commercialising and applying that research. So there's obviously a need to invest in health services, health policy and commercialisation. And this fund is an innovative way of doing that, because we'll have an endowment that will give a sustainable funding source over time. So I guess it's innovative in itself how this has been suggested we proceed.
Brendan Crabb, director of the Burnet Institute, do you think that many Australians have the perception that we're right up there with the best in terms of investment, in terms of world medical breakthroughs? We've got the legacy of the cochlear implant, the HPV vaccine, and a whole suite of other key discoveries, literally breakthroughs, actually. I mean, breakthroughs are rare, actually, in medical research, but we own quite a few.
Oh, I think Australians are very aware of it and very proud of it. As Christine says, there's very strong support for medical research. Not everyone can articulate everything that's happened, but they sort of realise that, you know, penicillin happened because of Australians and all the things you mentioned. You know, there's tremendous advances that people can tangibly understand.
Is that legacy enough, though?
Well, I think at the moment, you know, we've from time to time sought public support, and it's been overwhelming. So I think that what medical research gives to people is hope. You know, hope that the intractable diseases of today and the health concerns that every single one of us either have or have someone close to us that's affected by, the only hope for those is medical research. There is no other chance. And I think the public well and truly understand that. Solution to the various cancers and to heart disease and to diabetes and to the rare diseases isn't going to come out of thin air. There is no other solution but health and medical research. And, you know, we are grossly underinvesting. We're at two-thirds of the average OECD expenditure at the moment, of the average. So the Medical Research Future Fund, or the disbursements from it, are no windfall. They're going to bring us close to that average, which is absolutely where we should be.
Who's above average in the world?
Well, the United States have traditionally led it,
Is that through public money, or is that partly because they have such a robust public-private partnership mentality through philanthropy?
Purely public money, we're discussing on top of the public money in which they've led the world. They've had both philanthropy through big foundations like the Howard Hughes Foundation, now the Gates, and of course also industry investing well in research, and we have both of those as problematic here. But no, their federal budget government expenditure is substantially more per person, per percentage of GDP than ours, as are many other countries, especially within Europe now.
So, Brendan, the GP co-payment was to fund a big chunk of the Medical Future Fund as proposed by the federal government. It wasn't the only source of funding, that's important to be clear. But if the co-payment doesn't get up, as there is conjecture in the newspapers today that Tony Abbott may well dump it, where would the funding come from? Where could the funding come from?
Well, it's a good question as to where it could come from. Our point is that, you know, we're not equipped to identify the sources of savings. We would like to make a strong argument for why the fund needs to be $20 billion. You know, the $20 billion is not for medical research. It's a big number, but it's actually a saving for government. What is for medical research is the disbursements from that $20 billion, the interest payments, which over a decade should grow to around 5% of that $20 billion or $1 billion a year. Now, that will, according to the government's announcement last May, effectively double over a decade the Australia's commitment to health and medical research and bring us into line with the OECD average.
Christine,
that is a number that needs to happen. Anything substantially less than that isn't really addressing the problem.
Well, where did that figure come from, Christine Bennett, that original figure?
The $20
billion? Yeah.
Well, I think we've calculated if we did raise the $20 billion over the period that the government proposed last year, we'd actually be getting $1 billion to medical research, which would bring us to the OECD average. So, you know, I mean, it would be bringing us to where we should be.
And how would you then like that to be? What priority areas would you consider? Because that is in itself a dilemma for governments, isn't it? Do you fund the very clearly applied research? Do you fund the more blue sky, more abstract research that often, way down the track, serendipitously might have outcomes for our health and well-being?
Yes, look, you need a balance of all of those things, and we need a capability in Australia. You know, we need to have our own expertise so we can also translate and apply the research done elsewhere, and we need to have the capability also to respond to situations like Ebola and pandemics. And we need to be part of international collaborations that are increasingly the way of research into the future. So things like the human brain, you know, a major next research horizon, genomics, nanotechnology. So there are many areas from blue sky discovery through the applied, both clinical and pharmaceutical and device applied research, and then also in health policy and health services, so we can get a more efficient health system that's of better quality as well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see who listens, who hears your call in the Medical Journal of Australia, this coalition of medical researchers. Professor Christine Bennett, Chair of Research Australia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Natasha.
And Professor Brendan Crabb, Director and CEO of the Burnett Institute, thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And we'll include a link to that call in the Medical Journal of Australia. It is available for reading online. And I should just let you know that I'm going to be in Melbourne at Federation Square tomorrow night, that's Wednesday night, hosting an event with leading scientists, as it turns out, all about personalised medicine and the revolution of genomics and whether it really it will fulfil all the promises that have been made about it, including a leading Stanford geneticist, Michael Snyder, who's actually... he's a leading scientist, but he's also somewhat of a human guinea pig. He's going to be presenting on what he did to himself as part of his research. So that's BMW. That's at the Federation Square. I think it's 6 p.m. I'll pop the details up on our Facebook page, but you can Google it. Natasha Mitchell here with you for Life Matters here on ABCRN. We're getting our togs on, we're getting our wheelchairs out, and we're heading beachward.
Right now, there's a new way to listen to RN in the afternoons. Hi, I'm Michael McKenzie, and I've thrown off the mantle of food to bring other stories, music and conversation to the table. Between 1 and 3, listen for bite-sized pieces from Us, the BBC, Double J and Rural, mixed with news, live music and your tweets, emails and Facebook stories. It's afternoons, but not as you know it. 1 till 3, here on RN.
That Melbourne Conversations event on Wednesday is at 6pm at Federation Square, there at the Edge Theatre. Well, now we're heading to the beach. Summer's not over yet and you might be living along a coastline, squeezing as many swims out of the season as you can, if you can, that is, because I wonder if you have tried pushing a pram or a wheelchair across a sandy beach. Wheels and beaches, they don't mix. Where's that all-terrain vehicle when you need one? As it turns out, just the thing exists, and the Disabled Surfers Association is on the case. They're campaigning to make our great Australian beach experience more accessible to more people in various ways. Gary Blaski is their national president. Lynise Heffernan is the mother of 3.5-year-old Dexter. He's a resilient little boy, a survivor, as you'll hear. She joins us from Kiama on the gorgeous New South Wales south coast. Welcome, Lynise.
Thank you.
And I think we have you on the central coast of New South Wales, Gary.
Yes, you do.
Fantastic to have you both. Lynise, let's get a sense of Dexter. What's life like for him at 3.5?
For a 3.5-year-old, his life is incredibly busy, I'm going to say. Dexter, just a really brief rundown, he was born 9 weeks early. He then spent 17 weeks in hospital. When he was 1 month old, we were told that he had brain damage, which has then led to a vision impairment diagnosis and also severe cerebral palsy. And then to top it off, when he was 12 months old, he was diagnosed with liver cancer. But we're happy to say that he's 2 years cancer clear now.
This is all just in his first three and a half years.
Yeah. So it's very busy with him. He has lots of therapy that he has to do. He is totally reliant on us to do everything. So because of the cerebral palsy, he can't sit, he can't stand, talk, walk. He can't do anything, and we have to do it all.
And yet, given that you are walking distance from a beautiful beach, actually, the opportunity of getting him into the water and onto a beach is an important one for you, wasn't it? But incredibly hard to do. Describe how hard.
Well, it was almost impossible to do on my own. My husband works, my family all work, and so I am here during the days on my own. Dexter has 2 siblings. So Dexter's 3.5, and then he's got a 2-year-old sister and a 4-month-old sister. And so,
How are you doing that?
Oh, it's busy, but it's fun, so that's okay. But we live about 2 blocks back from the beach, and it's an absolutely gorgeous beach that we have here. And it is quite difficult to get Dexter down there, or it was. I would have to leave one child either on the beach on their own or in the car on their own, and while I was transporting the other one there. And it's just really difficult to do. You can't push the pram down there. The pram here is a specially modified pram, and it's probably at least 10 kilos heavier than all the other prams. And then you've got 2 children in that pram as well. So it's very, very difficult to do.
Very tough. But given that tantalising beach is so close to you, I can understand why you'd want to get there with the kids. All the kids, all 3 of them, including Dexter. So what changed? What happened that enabled you to do this?
Well, last year we were introduced to the world of beach wheelchairs, and then we were incredibly lucky. A local gym, they did a fundraising benefit for us and purchased a beach wheelchair for Dexter, which means that we can now put him on it, wheel him down. His sister can fit on it because he's a little bit little for it at the moment, so we can put her on there as well, and we can actually get him down into the sand. We can push him into just the shoreline, just so that we don't take him out deep, of course, but he can feel the waves, he can go over the waves, he can feel that floating sensation, he can hear them, he can smell it, he gets splashed by it.
What's it look
Everything
like?
That everyone does. It looks like a big chair with big four-wheel drive wheels. It stands out a lot because it is quite big.
Describe the scene then of his first encounter with the waves, real encounter in that chair.
he was so happy. He had a massive smile on his face, and it was such an exciting thing for all of us to be part of.
Let me, I know you've got the kids there calling for your attention. Let me bring Gary Blaski into the conversation, President of the Disabled Surfers Association of Australia. Accessibility to Australia's beaches and getting out there on the sand. This is personal to you, isn't it, Gary?
It's very personal. I've been running the DSA for 30 years, so I've been taking just about every disability to the beach and trying to get them across the sand. Many years ago, we used to physically carry them across the sand, which was indignant to them. And obviously, since the invention of the beach wheelchair, it's made not only our life a lot easier, but it put some dignity back into what we do.
But why this connection between disability access and Australia's beautiful beaches? Where did this come from in your own life?
Well, I was involved in a motorcycle accident many years ago and was told that I'd never surf again, and I'd surfed all my life, and so access to a beach was virtually impossible. And the reality is now that the Australian Bureau of Statistics says that 18.5% of the Australian population has some form of disability. Now, that doesn't include health issues like knees and hips and heart problems, because they're health issues. Mm. It doesn't include ageing issues either. So the reality is we've got 32% of our Australian population who doesn't have a chance to get down onto the beach or go for a walk with their loved ones along the beach in a beach wheelchair.
So you're about getting beaches to be more accessible, and obviously the beach wheelchair. And actually there's a few different models of beach wheelchair kicking around, aren't there?
Yes, and it's a real problem at the moment. Because they're becoming so popular, we've even got a Chinese import at the moment that has actually 13 things wrong with it. And I've raised it with the importer, and they've asked me to go back to China to actually talk to their engineers. But look, it just should not have been allowed to come into the country. And it has a TGA Australia approved sticker on it, which is just totally illegal.
So it's a beach wheelchair that is available to people, but it's not optimum. I mean, your organisation, Disabled Surfers Association of Australia, has been absolutely instrumental in sourcing or donating these chairs over the past 15 years. How available are they across beaches across Australia?
We have on our website 57 locations just in New South Wales where these wheelchairs are available. There's nobody doing an audit on these wheelchairs. No matter who owns them or who's looking after them, there is no system that is making sure that these chairs that may or may not be available in the surf club is actually kept up to scratch.
And that is, in fact, where many of them can be found, at the surf life-saving clubs across Australia. They store them, they loan them out. You don't think that that's necessarily an ideal scenario, given that your quest is for accessibility to these chairs?
Yeah, well, we've had a program called Adopt a Beach, and really it's a matter of speaking to the councils around Australia, especially the coastline, if not even inland, because there's no reason why we can't have them at river systems as well, and identifying a beach that is suitable, that has the infrastructure, that has the correct profile, that is not a high-impact beach. We're calling for local governments to identify one beach or maybe two in their region that we can advertise that is an accessible beach. And so it's not a matter of just having a wheelchair there. It's a matter of having disabled toilets and showers and a ramp, if possible, built to the right code. And you know, all the infrastructure has to be in place to make this work. My own council in Wyong, we've just completed building a, I believe it's the world's best access ramp at Lakes Beach, but we had a lot of trouble. We had so many legislations thrown in our face, it wasn't funny, but we eventually overrode them and we've built one.
In building that ramp in Wyong, just describe what a difference that has made.
Oh, look, it's absolutely being flogged by the disabled people. There are wheelchairs going up and down because it's nice and wide. They can pass one another. It's built at a 1 in 14 gradient with rest areas every 9 metres. So if you're pushing yourself up and you're getting tired, you can actually have a rest every 9 metres.
Brilliant.
So, you know, there's seats, there's an observation deck. But we'd love to see one of these type of ramps built at a specific beach. And I don't believe Surf Life Saving or surf clubs or surf schools or even councils have the expertise to identify what are the correct beaches for adopting a beach.
And that's where your organisation, the Disabled Surfers Association of Australia, enters the story. Lanice Heffernan there in beautiful Kiama, you've actually had your little boy Dexter also participate in something else that the Disabled Surfers Association does, and that is helping kids get on surfboards. So
yeah.
This is a little boy who really exists in a wheelchair full time. And so what happened?
It was an amazing day. It was absolutely pouring. But the Disabled Surfers Association, their motto is smiles on dials. And that's exactly what it was. Like I said, this day it was absolutely pouring. And we went down to one of our local beaches, Jaroa, and they had close to 100 volunteers, I guess. And they were putting all individuals, all types of disabilities on surfboards and fully supporting them and letting them actually catch the waves in. So they carried Dexter out on a surfboard, this little boy carried him out on this big long surfboard. They formed a tunnel, so people on either side of him, and they pushed him in on the waves and they let him actually catch the waves, which was just amazing.
I have to say, seeing that footage just moved me immeasurably. All these people in blue vests surrounding this little boy on a big surfboard. It was a beautiful scene when I watched the video.
The emotions that we had that day, they were absolutely just, they were all over the place, really. You were so happy. I was so scared because, you know, this is my little child who can't swim and can't tell us if anything's wrong, and yet I was just completely trusting him to go out with these people, and he was perfectly safe the entire time. But it was just amazing.
Do you reckon he was terrified?
No, I don't know. I think the first time he wasn't too sure. He didn't really give us much of an indication. But the second time he definitely gave us a bit of a smile. And he was freezing because the water was quite cold. But he didn't complain, which is a big thing for him. If he complains, it means he's had enough. But he certainly didn't complain about it. So he would have loved it.
Well, just briefly back to the wheelchairs. Actually, you've also been prompted to compile a list of beaches around Australia where people can borrow the beach wheelchairs, I gather. Such was your inspiration.
Yeah, I think we just wanted to, in getting that list together, we wanted to know ourselves where they were. We grew up on the north coast, or I grew up on the north coast of New South Wales, and that's where we sort of first got introduced to a beach wheelchair, and it was a local caravan park that had that, and they had a perfect ramp to get to the actual area where it was. And so we just wanted an idea of where they were, and because we didn't know about it, then we thought that other people might not know about it either. So my sister actually wrote the list. She did some research on the internet, did up this massive list, and then it got shared a few times online, and other people have come back and given us more ideas of where locations are.
And where can people find that? Is that on the Disabled Surfers Association list, Gary?
There is one list there, and then Lanice has got another list as well, so they can back it up on either side.
Excellent. Where can people find your list, Lanice?
Our list is on the Love Dexter website.
Oh, that's right. There's a beautiful blog that describes your life with Dexter. We'll link to that. But also, Gary, we'll link to your list as well.
Yeah.
Gary Blaski, just briefly, you have quite a pointed message for governments, but also for Surf Life Saving Australia. What is that message?
Look, the message is I think we really need all levels of government to take ownership of a program that allows this to happen. In New South Wales, we have a new legislation just approved, which is the Disability Inclusion Legislation, and that is to make sure that people have all the same rights as able-bodied people. So those with disabilities can do everything that anybody with no disability can do. But the government departments need to have this disability planning in place by the 1st of December 2015.
And you'd like Surf Life Saving Australia to apply some of the same principles.
They do have a beach access wheelchair good practice guide. But the problem is, it's a clause that gets them out, which is their risk hazard format, which they tick off. And if you ticked every one of them, yes, they'd be right, but the answer would be no to just about every one of the questions. So in other words, they have an out to get out with supplying these wheelchairs
right,
around Australia.
Because of liability issues. That's an interesting observation you make there. Thank you both for joining us to discuss this issue and the vital issue of accessibility across Australia's beaches.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gary Blaski there, National President of the Disabled Surfers Association. Lynise Heffernan, mum of three and a half-year-old Dexter, also mum of three. He's been riding those waves. She has too. And we'll include a link to the list of beaches that they've collated, actually, between them. Two different lists of beaches where there is a beach wheelchair available. I wonder if you caught our interview with Mel Leyland yesterday and last night's Australian Story featuring the Leyland brothers.
Ask the Leylands, travel all over the countryside, ask the Leyland brothers.
Yes, well, we got an interesting response from Catherine on our Facebook page in response to our interview with Mel yesterday. A little Leyland brothers trivia, she says. After owning the two Land Rovers for a couple of years, adventuring in them and featuring them in their off-the-beaten-track books, the brothers sold the station wagon Landy to my dad. That Landy stayed in our family for 32 years before, very regretfully, Dad sold it to make way for new Landys. Last we heard, it was bought to be restored back to its original look from when the Leyland brothers owned it and then headed for a museum. It would be great to know if this was successful. My sister and I grew up in that Landy. I learnt to drive in it and then drove it everywhere myself. We had many, many great adventures of our own in it. Great times. And so she has included a set of images of that Land Rover on our Facebook page under the Leyland brothers post. So if you recognise it, if you know the story, if you know whether it ended up in a museum, we'd really love to hear from you, so you can either post on our Facebook page or email us from our website, abc.net.au/rn, and look for Life Matters and you can email us there. Let's do a bit of collective detective work across the nation for the missing Land Rover. I just want to squeeze in a few comments in response to our discussion at the top of yesterday's show with Jed Carney from the ACTU and also a Telstra executive. We were looking at the ACTU's call for domestic violence leave to be made available to workers across Australia. And quite a response. Helen wrote, "Did they think this through?" Oh, and I just want to add that Telstra has implemented that policy, which is why we talked to them. So Helen wrote, "Did they think this through? Who would put domestic violence down on a work form? By all means, bring it out in the open, but HR departments already want to know too much about their employees." Anne wrote, "It's a good way to show initiative in removing the stigma, I think. A person who is a victim of domestic violence may feel powerless in their home, but they may feel empowered by the leave option and even brave enough to take that time. They may need it to create a plan to improve their situation." And Diane wrote, "If domestic violence is linked to money, maybe that will be a way to solve it." And Lorraine writes, "In my experience, domestic violence victims are so very fearful that there's no way they would confide in their employers. It's very likely they won't confide in their best friends or family. So just how do the powers that be think they would be helping the situation?" Jeff writes, "I think the City of Melbourne brought this in with their last enterprise agreement. It's a societal problem and employers are a fundamental part of society." To which Cynthia adds on our Facebook page, "I disagree. We are all part of society, but employers are not so social workers. How on earth can employers keep on paying their staff because something is going wrong in their lives? I'm not an employer, by the way, and never have been, but enough is enough." So, yes, quite a response, don't you think, to that call for domestic leave, domestic violence leave, and you can keep that conversation going on our Facebook page. There's our listener feedback line too. We love hearing from you. It's a way of getting in touch and leaving a comment. 0283 1430. Well, we're taking on the scammers next.
Could the coming year possibly see a different, a better political conversation? A special Saturday Extra panel considered the chances. Gareth Effens had one particular suggestion.
Any reform is going to generate losers, no doubt about that. The question is how you handle the politics of that and how you come up with compensation packages, alternative ways of things being done. Okay, there's some people going to lose on this, but they will benefit in other ways.
Hear the whole discussion, Making Sense of 2015, by accessing the RN website.
Meeting of partners online is hardly unusual these days. I know a few married couples who met that way. But like all things love, opening your heart can come with risks, including, and I'm very sorry to be totally unromantic about this, the risk of finding yourself on the wrong side of a scam with a hemorrhaging bank account to match. In fact, investigators say the majority of internet scams are now dating scams, and millions of dollars are leaving this country, wired by Australians to overseas scammers that they've fallen prey to. Writer and investigative journalist Sophia Stefanovic has seen the impact at close hand in her book You're Too Good to Be True, a love story about lonely hearts and internet scams. She tells the story of an older friend, Bill. And you might have met Bill briefly yourself in a series that went to air on ABC television, Sabor Bradley's Head On series, which she was involved in. And she joins us now in our Melbourne studio. Sophia, welcome.
Thank you, Natasha. How are you?
I'm very well. So you first met Bill because you were working on this TV series. He's a gentleman in his 80s. Just introduce us to what had happened to him.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago I met Bill and he had just come out of his scam. So the police had approached him because they'd noticed some suspicious transfers leaving his account and going through Western Union to West Africa. And so the police in Brisbane actually approach people when they see that happening, and they take a proactive approach rather than a crime being reported. They'll door knock. And so they went to his place and, said, we think you might be the victim of a scam. And so when I met him, he had just come out of this scam that had all started as a romance, right? So he'd gone online dating, and eventually it had grown into this kind of horrible romance scam in which he'd lost all his money, about $100,000. And that's when I first spoke to him, when he was kind of done with his scam, and we stayed friends. He's this really interesting and lovely and funny and fascinating person. And we stayed in touch and we became friends. And a little while later, maybe two years later.
He wasn't done with his scam. He wasn't done with his scam. And this is the story that you tell, which is such a striking story of how deeply these scammers dig in with their emotional hooks into people's lives and minds and hearts.
That's right, yeah. And so this book, which is You're Just Too Good to Be True, is basically about how I went to his place and found, and there was something a little bit off. Like we were chatting and he just seemed a bit sad, and I thought, oh, I think this is happening again. I think he's being scammed. And this sort of led to a deeper investigation of scams, and that's what the book is about. Basically, it's why it happens to people and the other side of the story, as well as scammer side.
So even when a victim, so to speak, becomes aware that they are being scammed, in fact, the scammers use that information in interesting ways, as we'll discover. Bill had a married life. His wife had died. He then came out as gay, as a mature man, as an older man. And the original scam was via a man that he apparently met on the internet called Miller Duncan, a fictional American soldier in Afghanistan. How did the scam operate?
Well, that's it's really interesting how these scams operate. So as far as Bill is concerned, Miller Duncan was a real person who he met on the internet. In my opinion, the scam actually started there and there was no such person. So usually scammers will invent a, say a handsome soldier who is in Afghanistan, and they'll use pictures that they've taken from the internet of someone. So they'll steal pictures and put them up, and they might steal someone's profile and use that, or they might look at your, so if you're online dating, you'll have a section that says what I look for in a partner, right? So often scammers will read that, and then, you know, lo and behold, you'll meet someone who is exactly all the things that you looked for in a partner. And
that's what internet dating's about.
Yeah.
And comparing your profile to someone else's and looking for the potential.
And it makes it so, I mean, in some ways it makes it good because you can, you know, you get to see what other people are like and you find like-minded people on the internet. That's kind of the idea behind it. But for scammers, imagine there's all this information about you that's right there, and then they can use that to their advantage. So Bill met this person who was, you know, he was looking for companionship. He's 80, he's a bit older than that now, but when he went online, he was 80 and he was looking for just someone to spend the rest of his life with. And this person was lovely and interested in him and, you know, would be in touch with him all the time and would be really attentive. And if you're a senior person who lives by themselves, as Bill was, it's lovely having all this attention and love, and just suddenly being showered with all this great stuff.
Although he said to you, it wasn't love so much, it was hope. Yeah. And that was a really striking comment that he made to you. What was that hope full of?
It is striking, isn't it? Whenever you talk to Bill, he gives these great insights. I think he was, you know, I think it's just a hope for a better life. So I think that he was hoping to, he expresses this as well, to be held by someone. And that's just something that we all want, I think. Mm. I found that with scam victims who I've talked to, they're just people who want attention and care and love. So he said that he wasn't necessarily in love, but he was optimistic. He was willing to give it a go.
So Miller Duncan dies.
Yeah, he dies in Afghanistan, and then suddenly Bill is stuck with all sorts of things, like the bill for the funeral. He's named as next of kin. He's asked to pay all sorts of things. And for someone, as you know, I keep saying, for someone who's senior and who's never been online dating before and who's never heard about scammers, that something like that exists, he believes it, and he gets all these certificates in the mail and watermarked things and all these amazing
from officials.
From officials,
so apparent officials. But the thing is, the police are very keen. This team in Brisbane who have really led the charge in approaching victims, and probably in a quite an under-supported way, I get the sense. But they are quite keen to dispel what they perceive to be a myth of people being really gullible, that the people who fall prey to these scammers are totally gullible people.
Yeah, that's what I found is there are gullible people who do fall for scams, but also it could happen to, I truly believe that it could happen to anyone. So the people who I've met, the thing that they have in common is that they're at a vulnerable point in their life. So either they're recently widowed, or they're separated, or they're going through a rough patch. So generally they're vulnerable and they're ready for something. They're really wanting to find someone to love them. So it's much easier, I think, to be drawn into something if you're ready for it. You're willing to overlook certain things that might be a little bit suspicious. So one thing that I found was that the scam victims I spoke to were at a vulnerable point in their life. Mm. And the other thing is that generally they were very kind and generous people. So they were people who, you know, their friends always go to them for help, or they're the ones who you can always lean on and rely on. And they're the people who actually get singled out. And it's very sad because they're all good traits, right? it's kindness that attracts this sort of behaviour. And I don't think that they're gullible people, because some of these scammers, I mean, in some of these romance scams, a scammer will talk to you for a year before asking you for money.
That was incredible. The patience. The patience. This is not that they really want to get their hooks in emotionally first, yeah. And a year later, that's when they, and you actually watched some of the dialogue, you saw some of the dialogue, in fact you participated in some of the dialogue,
yes,
in an
yes.
effort, I think, to scam the scammers.
Yeah, I really wanted to speak to a scammer, because I wanted to see that the incredible psychological tactics that they use. So they absolutely, that they'll usually wait for a declaration of love before they ever ask for any money, and sometimes that does take a year, because people, you know, you don't fall in love that quickly all the time. And they will, they'll bide their time. They'll find out what sort of vulnerabilities you might have. And eventually when they get to know you quite well and they've gathered quite a file on you, because they do keep, often scammers, keep record of all these things. Then only then will they strike and ask for money. So it's pretty amazing. And it's a pretty, some of these operations are very, very serious, and some of them, I think the police told me that there was one syndicate that they found that spends over $1 million a year just on printing, so printing certificates and watermarked things and, you know, to fake passports and all sorts of things.
We'll come
like
back
that.
To Bill, and also what happened to you when you went online. Sophia Stefanovic is with me this morning. She's the author of You're Just Too Good to Be True, an investigation of internet scams. And it's interesting that you acknowledge that the people that you've spoken to who fall prey to these dating scams are real givers. They're community spirited. Mm-hmm. And one of the researchers you spoke to, Sophia, suggested that the tactics that scammers use are rather like domestic violence.
Yes.
They cut their victims off from their networks and their friendship groups. How do they do that? How do they achieve that when they're miles and miles away?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different things that you can do to suck someone in. And one of the things that scammers do is they often call first thing in the morning and the last thing at night. So that's the first voice you hear in the morning and the last one you hear at night. So often they call in the middle of the night when you're vulnerable and just woken up. And so the scammer ends up kind of taking up a lot of your mind space, right? Because you're thinking of them first thing in the morning, last thing at night. They'll also often say, oh, your family, they don't understand our relationship. They talk to the scam victims a lot more often than their family does. So often these people, they have kids living away from home who are adults themselves, and these adult children don't spend as much time on the phone with their elderly parent as a scammer does. So this way, you know, slowly they kind of chip away at the victim, and they ensure that they are the key, they are the most important person in the victim's life. Yeah.
So Bill came to understand, well, was told, I mean, that's the striking thing about the story you tell here. He has been told quite clearly that he's been scammed. People have presented the evidence to him. He has participated in support groups. He has, as you describe it quite beautifully, I think, he's been led gently back into the world. And yet, what do you encounter in this story? Why does he still feel that it's real?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the more I think that I had this sort of hope at the start that I would be able to solve all of Bill's problems, and that, you know, because I'm his friend and I know stuff about scams and I've done research, and I just had this kind of idea that I would lead him out of this thing and he would believe me and he would be a changed person and he would meet someone in real life. And I think that in the case of romance scams, I think it's a little bit like addiction, and I think that people won't come out of it unless they're ready to come out of it.
But what does he still believe? What does
he believes
he still
that
believe?
There is money coming to him. So he believes he's lost all this money and he will get it back. And he thinks that it's held up. He's in this sort of crazy web of bureaucracy. So he gets emails all the time. And instead of saying this is all a scam, which is what the police tell him all the time and what I believe as well, that all the contacts he gets are scams. He thinks, what if one of them isn't?
Well, the scammers
really is the police.
They are masquerading as police and officials and sending documentation to that effect.
Absolutely. They masquerade as officials, they masquerade as bank workers, they masquerade as police, customs officials. And so he has all these, can you imagine the stress of waking up and just having so many emails, all of them from these kind of bullying bureaucrats saying, yes, we've got, you will get your $100,000 back, you'll be able to pay back all of your debts, you'll be able to finally be happy again if only you send this tiny bit of money. And people do that a lot. I mean, with gambling, people do that. It's that idea, it's called sunk cost fallacy, so that you throw in, you've spent a certain amount of money and you think, oh, if I just spend a little bit more, I'll get it back. You know, that kind of, but that's not actually true. If you've spent a certain amount of money, if you spend a bit more, there's no guarantee that you'll get it back. But it's this sort of belief that one day you'll finally manage to do it. And I think it's very hard to come out of a scam if everyone's told you you're foolish, you're being scammed, to actually admit to that. That's really hard to do as well.
Yeah, it's quite heartbreaking watching Bill's story unfold. It's intriguing to watch you first go online with your own identity, realise that that's not going to work because you out yourself as a journalist pretty early on.
Yes.
Can't help yourself. So you adopt the persona of your dead aunt.
Great aunt.
Dead great aunt.
Well, I was, to be honest,
a little bit dubious.
I know. It did get quite murky for a while there because I thought that people would, I assumed that scammers would talk to me. I thought that if I went there and I said, I'm a journalist, I know you guys have a really bad write-up, will someone talk to me off the record and just, or anonymously, and just tell me what it's like being a scammer? I actually was hopeful that someone would talk to me,
no,
but they didn't.
They shut you right out. So then,
they shut me right
Cindy,
out.
But Cindy from Senegal was rather partial to...
she really was.
...to your character, your presence online.
That's right. So I ended up speaking to someone called Cindy, who first she thought that I was a man and started off being very romantic with me. And then I admitted that I was a woman and she immediately agreed to carry on the relationship. She did a very quick turnaround. She said something like, I've never been with a woman, but I'm willing to give it a go. So
and
we ended
fairly
up...
fairly soon professed her love for you. And
yes,
she wasn't as sophisticated as some of the others who really do spin it out over a year.
It's true. She was working pretty fast. So yeah, I set up a fake identity using my great aunt's photograph because elderly people are more likely to get scammed. So I used her photo, and I also made contact with this person called Cindy through email. So I started talking to scammers all over the place,
and they got in touch as soon as that profile went up.
Oh yeah,
they were there.
So
and
I
ready
made a profile
waiting.
Of it. Of a younger person, and I didn't get as many hits. And then I made a profile with my great aunt, and I said that she was a Christian, which is another thing that draws scammers in.
Yeah. The givers.
Givers. I also said that I had kids living away from home, that I was retired. All that stuff just says superannuation. You know, so scammers are clever like that. They'll look for someone who has savings. They often go for people who have disability pensions as well. Yeah, so I just got so many contacts.
So, I mean, Cindy and you didn't get together, obviously. This was your effort to be an investigative journalist, as you are.
That's right.
How do you want people to read this book? And just as we conclude, give us a sense of the scale. Has anyone tried to quantify this?
Yeah, well, the thing is, most scams go unreported, and that's why we don't really know how much money is going out of Australia yearly. From reported scams, I think in 2013, there were $25 million, but I think it's much, much more than that because most people don't report it.
Yeah.
And so Bill lost $100,000. I've spoken to people who have lost $1 million, and there are people who have
million
lost even more than
dollars.
That. Yeah. So just sent absolutely everything they have. But the way
such
I love
was the sophistication of the case.
Amazing.
With people saying, oh, you've lost your partner to that illness. My daughter's now got that illness. Help me. You know, I mean,
yes.
It's amazing what people
they
do.
They use incredible tactics. And I think I'd really like people to read this book and see that this is quite a complex issue because I think that both scam victims and scammers get a very bad write-up. And I think that people think that scam victims are gullible and foolish. And I think they think scammers are plain evil, while I actually think that it's more complex and there's individuals behind all these stories, and it could happen to you or to someone you love. So I guess the aim of my investigation was to try and see a little bit deeper into this issue.
Yes, and it's intriguing that you somewhat sympathise with the scammer that you found yourself conversing with. Look, it's a very interesting read. It's a little read because it's one of the Penguin specials, a short essay effectively, and thank you very much for taking the time because I'm wondering if anyone is listening and thinking, oh, that could be me. Sophia, thank you.
Thank you so much, Natasha.
Sophia Stefanovic, the book A Penguin Special is called You're Just Too Good to Be True, a love story about lonely hearts and internet scams. But there's no scamming here, only books and arts, coming up straight after the news.
Oh, books and arts is too good to be true, I sometimes think.
that's wonderful. you're getting operatic on us.
We are getting operatic. So there's lots of opera in Australia. There are state theatre companies. There's the National Opera Australia. And there have been some fantastic works on. But in the mix, where are the Australian operas? You know, we expect theatre companies to put on Australian plays. We expect Screen Australia to fund movies that tell Australian stories. But where are the Australian operas? There aren't many.
Yes, indeed. And what stories would they tell? That's the thing about opera. I rather like a contemporary opera, although I'm not a big opera fan, I have to say. But can they tell a story on stage? Books and Arts, Michael Cathcart, after the 10 a.m. news. Thanks for your company.